Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Right, and the operational bottom line up front is that the traditional indicators of military power are currently being subverted by commercial technology and asymmetric tactics. We are seeing nations like Ukraine, Russia, North Korea, and Iran completely bypassing conventional constraints through the deep integration of civilian supply chains and proxy networks. This fundamentally alters the threat landscape, moving the decisive points of conflict from traditional battlefields to digital networks, commercial warehouses, and global shipping choke points.
Exactly. And, you know, you might think modern war is just about who has the biggest tanks or the most troops. But what if the real front lines actually involve, like Chinese magnets, fake medical software updates, and secret transit tolls on the high seas?
Yeah, that is the reality of the tactical environment we're looking at today. It's incredibly murky.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are taking a really sweeping look at how nations are radically adapting their military and diplomatic strategies to navigate modern conflict, sanctions, and resource constraints. Our mission today is to help you connect the dots between some seemingly isolated global events.
Right, and we're pulling from a massive stack of sources for this. We've got a deep dive podcast from the Royal United Services Institute, or USI, regional updates from the Institute for the Study of War, a paper from the Association of the United States Army on Cyber Warfare, and some recent on-the-ground reporting from Al Jazeera and the War Zone.
It's a lot of ground to cover. But when you synthesize all of this, you really start to understand the new unwritten rules of 21st century statecraft.
Absolutely. And to understand how warfare is fundamentally shifting, I mean, the most logical starting point is the most visible laboratory for modern conflict right now, which is Ukraine. The sheer scale of adaptation happening there is just unprecedented. The RUSI podcast featuring Dr. Jack Watling provides some honestly staggering numbers. If you look back to 2014, Ukraine was operating with a neglected Soviet legacy force of about 250,000 personnel.
Which is not small, but...
Right, but they could only field 10 brigades on the front line back then. Fast forward to today, and they have a defense force of 960,000 personnel.
Oh, wow. Almost a million.
Exactly. Managing 120 frontline brigades.
See, the mechanism behind that expansion is what I find so fascinating, because we tend to think of military growth purely in terms of a traditional draft, you know, just pulling citizens into uniform. But the sources show this massive influx of civilian talent and private capital actively reshaping the defense sector from the outside.
Yeah, it's a totally different approach.
You have these tech entrepreneurs, logistics experts, and business leaders who basically brought their civilian Silicon Valley-style operational culture right into a wartime environment.
And that cultural shift is the critical variable here, because traditional Western defense procurement operates on what you might call a waterfall model.
Oh, right. The endless red tape.
Exactly. A government identifies a need, spends years writing requirements, puts it out to bid, and then some prime contractor spends a decade developing it.
Right.
So by the time a new drone or a communication system actually hits the battlefield, it is exhaustively certified, incredibly expensive, heavily over-engineered, and frankly, potentially obsolete against current threats.
Whereas the Ukrainian model is entirely iterative. The civilian-military hybrid model just asks, what is the minimum viable product required to solve the immediate tactical problem?
Spot on.
Ukrainian entrepreneurs are taking on massive personal financial risks to spin up these small manufacturing hubs.
Mm-hmm.
They're iterating drone designs on a weekly basis. I mean, if a drone is only designed to fly a one-way kamikaze mission, it doesn't need a 10-year lifespan certification, right?
No, not at all.
It doesn't need millions of dollars in all-weather testing. It just needs to work well enough today for a few hundred dollars. And that mindset built what they are calling the wall of drones,
which creates this incredible sensor shooter network that just blanket covers the battlefield. But, you know, we have to be careful not to fall into the trap of thinking technology has entirely rewritten the rules of war.
Right.
The narrative that we are entering an era of purely remote push-button warfare is a dangerous oversimplification.
I was actually going to bring that up because the War Zone reporting highlighted that Ukraine just officially ordered Gripen fighter jets.
Yes.
So despite this absolute swarm of drones in the sky, they're clearly still investing heavily in conventional manned air power. I think there's this romanticized idea floating around, like a modern equivalent of WWII-style shadow factories churning out autonomous weapons that basically render old tools dead.
Right, like tanks are suddenly obsolete.
Exactly. With all these drones, our traditional weapons, like tanks and infantry, just giant obsolete metal targets now.
Well, no. The human element and heavy armor haven't been replaced at all. The tactical geometry has just changed. Combined arms approaches, integrating artillery, armor, and infantry, are still the only way to actually take and hold ground. A drone cannot physically occupy a trench.
That makes sense.
To put the sheer density of human force into perspective, the RUSI analysis pointed out a really sobering statistic. More Russian soldiers attacked the single Ukrainian town of Pokrovsk than exists in the entire British Army.
Wait, really? That is a staggering metric.
It is. And when you are dealing with that scale of mass and attrition, a swarm of drones alone is insufficient. You still need artillery to suppress the enemy. You still need armored vehicles to physically protect infantry while they maneuver. And you still need the infantry to actually clear a defensive line.
So drones are just another piece of the puzzle.
Exactly. They act as a highly effective new layer that makes everything more lethal. But they are operating within a very old, very brutal paradigm of industrial warfare.
But sustaining that level of industrial attrition requires an unbelievable amount of raw material, which actually brings up a bizarre contradiction in the sources regarding how these war machines are actually built. It turns out no one fights in a vacuum.
Right.
Everyone, regardless of what side of the geopolitical divide they sit on, relies on the exact same global supply chains.
The interconnectedness of defense manufacturing is just one of the great paradoxes of modern conflict. The sources highlight that Western militaries produce the most highly advanced precision missiles in the world, yet the titanium used in the airframes of those metals is overwhelmingly extracted and refined in Russia.
It's crazy. And the dependency goes in every direction. Think about the drones we were just discussing. Every single quadcopter flying over that battlefield, whether it's being operated by Ukrainian forces or Russian forces, relies on a specific type of brushless electric motor.
Yep.
And the core component of those motors are rare earth magnets. And the global market for extracting and processing those magnets is almost entirely dominated by China.
So you have this bizarre situation where the foundational building blocks of 21st century combat are just sitting in commercial warehouses, moving freely across borders, often originating from the very nations that are engaged in indirect conflict with one another.
It's basically the geopolitical equivalent of trying to build an impenetrable fortress. But you have to buy all your bricks and mortar from your enemy's hardware store.
That's a great way to put it.
It exposes a massive flaw in how we think about economic warfare. If the global supply chain is this porous, how do international sanctions even work anymore?
Well, the short answer is they're struggling. The mechanism of traditional deterrence and economic isolation is definitely failing when it comes to dual-use technology. Sanctions work really well on highly specialized, easily trackable military hardware like, say, a nuclear centrifuge or a bespoke radar system.
Sure, things that are obviously military.
Exactly. But when a critical component is a dual-use commercial good, the enforcement just falls apart. You cannot effectively sanction the microchips that guide a smart bomb without also crashing the global supply chain for washing machines, smartphones, and automotive sensors.
Right.
The global market is just too fluid, and states will always find a backdoor, a middleman, or a shell company to get what they need.
Which provides the perfect lens to examine North Korea. The UN has arguably the strictest sanctions regime on the planet targeting Pyongyang, supposedly isolating them entirely. But the Institute for the Study of War's Korean Peninsula updates paint a completely different picture.
A very different picture.
Russian enterprises from Siberia, specifically out of hubs like Khabarovsk and Irkutsk, are openly flouting UN sanctions. They have business delegations visiting Pyongyang, securing deals for energy, liquid natural gas, and construction projects.
And we really need to look at how these transactions actually function, because this isn't just cash moving through banks. Because both nations are locked out of the SWIFT international banking system to varying degrees, they rely on barter economies and commodity swaps.
Right, trading goods for goods.
Exactly. Russia provides raw energy and technical assistance. And in exchange, North Korea opens up its massive stockpiles of Soviet-caliber artillery shells and ballistic missiles to support Russia's war effort in Ukraine.
And this transactional relationship is giving Kim Jong an incredible economic and diplomatic cover to rapidly modernize his armed forces. The scale of what they are attempting is huge. The sources note they recently commissioned the Cho Hyon-class guided missile destroyer,
which is now North Korea's largest warship.
Right. And even more aggressively, Kim is pushing to construct a 10,000-ton strategic guided missile cruiser, specifically designed to support sea-launched ballistic missiles.
They are pairing this naval expansion with severe physical posturing on the ground, too. They are systematically clearing minefields and have extended their border fences to sit just 82 meters from the military demarcation line.
Wow. 82 meters.
Yeah. And they have completely rejected any return to denuclearization talks. All of this is happening while, just across the border, South Korean President Lee Jae-myung is grappling with intense domestic pressures, seeing his approval ratings slide down to 46.5%.
I do have to challenge the reality of this naval buildup, though. I mean, announcing a 10,000-ton cruiser is great for domestic propaganda, but building and operating one is a massive, highly complex leap in naval engineering.
Oh, absolutely.
To sustain what they call a green water Navy ships capable of operating in the open ocean, away from the safety of coastal defenses, you need an incredibly complex logistical tail. You need deep water dry docks for maintenance, specialized underway replenishment ships to refuel them at sea.
Layered air defense systems.
Exactly. To protect an asset of that size. North Korea simply does not possess that infrastructure. Without it, a 10,000-ton cruiser is essentially a giant, slow-moving metal target.
Mm-hmm.
Are they biting off more than they can chew, or is this a genuine game-changer for their nuclear deterrence?
Well, the logistical hurdles you are describing are absolutely real. Operating a capital ship is entirely different from building a coastal patrol boat. However, focusing solely on the structural viability of the ships might miss the broader threat vector here.
How so?
Because the ISW sources report a terrifying secondary effect of this alliance. Russian technical assistance is drastically improving the underlying technology of North Korea's existing arsenal, particularly their ballistic missiles.
The precision data in the reporting is what caught my attention there.
Yes, the metric to look at is the CEP, or circular error probable, which is basically how militaries measure the accuracy of a weapon. The margin of error on North Korea's KN-23 and KN-24 ballistic missiles has reportedly been reduced from kilometers down to just 1 to 5 meters.
That's insane. Shrinking an impact zone from the size of a city down to the size of a single room fundamentally changes what that weapon is capable of doing.
It alters the entire strategic calculus of the region. A missile with a margin of error of several kilometers is a pair weapon. You fire it at a city and hope to hit something valuable.
Right.
A missile with a margin of error of 1 meter is a precision tactical weapon. You can target a specific command bunker, a critical bridge, or a runway. You don't need to fire 10 missiles to guarantee neutralizing a target. You only need one.
Wow.
So regardless of the infrastructural growing pains they might face building a green water navy, the raw, localized threat of their conventional and nuclear deterrence is escalating dramatically thanks to this geopolitical partnership.
So we have a North Korea reacting to constraints by building massive, highly visible weapons giant ships and precise ballistic missiles. But looking at the source material regarding Iran, we see the exact opposite methodology.
Right, a total pivot.
Iran is leveraging invisible digital networks and asymmetric pressure to bypass constraints, really focusing on the spaces where traditional military power struggles to respond.
We are shifting from the physical mechanics of warfare to digital and economic choke points here. The paper from the Association of the United States Army details Iran's highly evolved strategy of utilizing semi-independent proxy hacking groups.
Cyber mercenaries, basically.
Exactly. These are advanced, persistent threat actors operating under names like the Handala Hack Team and the Cutting Sword of Justice.
And the damage they inflict is incredibly tangible. To put this in perspective for anyone listening, this isn't just about defacing websites. The AUSA paper breaks down what is known as a wiper attack.
Which is very different from ransomware.
Right. Unlike ransomware, where hackers lock your data and demand a payout to return it, a wiper attack is designed purely for destruction. It overwrites the master boot record of a system, permanently destroying the data. The paper cites the 2012 attack on Saudi Aramco, where Iranian proxies wiped 30,000 computers.
30,000.
Yeah, forcing the global oil giant to halt operations for 11 days. And more recently, there was the 2026 wiper attack on Stryker, which is a major medical technology supplier.
The cascading effects of that Stryker attack are a perfect example of asymmetric impact. By wiping over 200,000 personal and company devices, they didn't just disrupt manufacturing, they interrupted global medical supply chains.
Which affects everyday people.
Right. Surgeries were delayed and hospitals scrambled for equipment for over 2 weeks.
Which brings up the core logic of using proxies. plausible deniability. It is essentially digital privateering. By using groups that operate on a loose leash, meaning they align with the state's broad strategic intent but operate their own day-to-day infrastructure, Iran can inflict heavy economic and societal damage on adversaries without crossing the threshold that would provoke a direct conventional military retaliation.
That is exactly the attribution problem that the AVSA paper explicitly highlights. In the physical world, if a missile is launched, satellites track the heat signature to the exact launch pad. In the digital realm, the forensic trail might bounce through compromised servers in 5 different countries before dead-ending. Even if intelligence agencies are incredibly confident the hackers are state-sponsored, proving it definitively in real time to the international community is incredibly difficult. This limits the ability of the West to effectively deter these attacks.
But I get the appeal of using proxy hackers. But isn't delegating that much destructive capability to semi-independent actors incredibly reckless? Like, what happens if a proxy group, perhaps driven by a desire for financial extortion or just raw ideological zeal, goes rogue?
That's the million-dollar question.
If they accidentally wipe the control systems for a civilian power grid during a winter storm, causing mass casualties, that could easily trigger a kinetic response. You could stumble into a physical shooting war entirely by accident.
The risk of miscalculation and unintended escalation is immense. And that same strategy of deliberate ambiguity is mirrored in Iran's physical asymmetric strategy as well. According to the reporting from ISW and Al Jazeera, Iran is heavily pushing a regional security mechanism designed to expel the United States from the Middle East.
Right.
And their primary leverage in this geopolitical maneuver is the Strait of Hormuz, one of the most vital shipping lanes for global energy markets.
They are using the threat of maritime disruption to force diplomatic hands. The Al Jazeera reporting detailed the ongoing indirect negotiations taking place in Doha, Qatar. U.S. envoys, specifically Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, are there attempting to establish the implementation of a 60-day ceasefire memorandum of understanding and negotiating the release of frozen Iranian assets.
But the catch is, Iran refuses to even engage in direct face-to-face talks.
They don't have to engage directly because they hold the asymmetrical cards. There is currently a proposal from Oman to institute transit fees for shipping companies moving through the strait. Oman frames these fees as voluntary, perhaps to fund maritime safety initiatives, but Iranian officials are already publicly framing them as mandatory.
And if the international shipping community starts paying mandatory transit tolls to navigate international waters, that effectively means the world is recognizing Iranian sovereignty and control over a critical global choke point.
Which is a huge win for them.
Absolutely, which is exactly why the U.S. is countering with physical presence. The ISW sources note that U.S. Central Command CENTCOM is deploying ground forces to Israel and Lebanon. Their stated mission is to monitor compliance with the Trilateral Framework Agreement.
But wait, putting U.S. boots on the ground is a major escalation of commitment. How does deploying ground troops actually counter an asymmetric strategy like transit fees in the Strait?
It's about narrative control. It neutralizes Iran's advantage in the region's newly established deconfliction cell. Previously, because the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps maintains such a strong embedded presence on the ground in Lebanon, they could rapidly report alleged ceasefire violations and dictate the tactical narrative.
Well, I see.
If there was a skirmish, Iran's proxies were the only ones providing data. By deploying CENTCOM ground forces, the U.S. establishes an independent capability to verify incidents, respond instantly, and basically prevent Iran from manipulating the reality on the ground to justify further aggression.
So as we pull all of these threads together, the picture of modern conflict is radically different from the conventional wisdom.
Yeah, it really is.
We started by looking at how Ukrainian civilians are crowdsourcing the development of suicide drones, bypassing decades of bureaucratic defense procurement. This exposed the uncomfortable reality that both sides of a conflict are relying on the exact same Chinese rare earth magnets and Russian minerals to build their arsenals.
We then examined how traditional economic sanctions are failing against dual-use technologies, allowing North Korea to leverage a barter economy with Russia. They are trading munitions for the technical assistance needed to build 10,000-ton cruisers and transform their ballistic missiles from inaccurate terror weapons into highly precise tactical threats.
Right. And finally, we looked at Iran's mastery of the loose leash, utilizing invisible proxy hackers to cripple global medical suppliers with wiper attacks, while simultaneously threatening to choke off the Strait of Hormuz to extract diplomatic and financial concessions in Doha.
All of this points to a fundamental transformation in how global power is projected and maintained. The traditional markers of strength-standing armies and deep-water navies are being heavily augmented, and in some cases bypassed, by commercial workarounds and asymmetric tactics.
This whole new world.
It is, and it leaves us with a critical, lingering question to consider. If the machinery of modern warfare increasingly relies on off-the-shelf commercial components, deeply porous global supply chains, and autonomous proxy groups who operate in the shadows, will the wars of the future be decided not by governments, diplomats, and generals, but by the private corporations and rogue actors who actually control the underlying tools of conflict?
If the state no longer holds a monopoly on the mechanisms of war, the entire foundation of global stability shifts. It is definitely something to think about the next time you update the software on your devices or look at where the components in your electronics were sourced. From all of us here, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the changing face of global conflict. We will catch you next time.